The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a complimentary subscription to Real Assets Advisor Newsline and Magazine. Curious about real estate, infrastructure, energy, commodities, alternative investments, or real assets in general? Real Assets Advisor is curated intelligent news, data, and insights to suit your needs. Visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today using our new chat feature.
The following podcast is sponsored by AppFolio Investment Management.
In a recent study, AppFolio Investment Management customers reported up to 70% growth in their total EUM over a one-year period. How? They were able to cut fundraising time down by 50%, automate waterfall distributions, and impress investors with a professional self-service investor portal. AppFolio Investment Management is your partner in commercial real estate. Learn why thousands of real estate investment managers are choosing AppFolio Investment Management at appfolioinvestmentmanagement.com.
Hi, this is Pat Soldano. I am president of Family Enterprise USA. The sole mission and purpose of Family Enterprise USA is to promote family businesses and their job growth in the United States.
And this is Mike Consul, your host. And Pat, we welcome you to the program. And we're going to be talking about the annual survey that your organization does with family businesses. You've mined some fresh information about what's going on in that space. And before we get to that, let me start with this question, though. I just want your opinion on this. Is capitalism in the United States in crisis or not?
Well, I'm not sure, I guess is the answer. I think it's different. Unfortunately, capitalism, the term capitalism, is viewed negatively now by voters. And we've done some work around that with Frank Luntz, and they don't see capitalism as a positive thing. They see economic freedom as a positive thing. So in some cases, people have kind of changed the dialogue from using the phrase capitalism to economic freedom or free enterprise.
And in fact, we met at an investment conference and you shared the stage with Frank Luntz. And for our listeners, you're probably familiar with Frank. He's the political consultant and communications specialist. So people like the idea of freedom. The word capitalism has become pejorative for a lot of people, is what you have found out, Pat. However, what other economic system is there that allows freedom, really, other than capitalism? I think people like to say, you know, if you get disenchanted with capitalism, just look at these other systems and you tell me what's a better system. Why do you think, though, that we have soured on capitalism, that there's a large segment of the population? I think it's mostly young people who are saying, I'm not so sure capitalism is where we is good.
Yeah, because I think there's been a lot of negative media around successful people that have been termed, you know, capitalist. And I think that's really unfortunate. I mean, what we say is, don't we want successful people in this country? Don't we want successful enterprises in this country? I think it is really unfortunate. And there's been bad examples of capitalists, right? But to your point, I think it is the best system. I mean, what else is there? It is really true free enterprise. It is all about demand and supply. And people taking risks and building businesses and being entrepreneurial. And that, I think, is in some cases unique to the United States. So I think it's sad that the younger generation doesn't see that, doesn't understand it. They want to be philanthropic. They want to impact the world. They want the world to be a better place. And I really respect them for that. I totally agree with them. But you need capitalism or you need for-profit organizations in order to support these causes or these nonprofits. Organizations. And I made that point when Frank and I were on stage together. If there is no profit organizations, how are they going to contribute to these not-for-profit organizations? Or how are individuals who contribute more than corporations to these not-for-profit organizations that do such great work, how are they going to survive? So I think that they just really haven't seen the big picture. And they do want to make the world a better place, which is why one of the things that was discussed at this conference is impact investing and why the younger generation is so strongly supporting impact investing. And impact investing, as you know, is in investing for an impact to change the world, not just investing for a return. When impact investing started, it was really just around doing good and not doing bad. that world has changed. Now you can truly do impact investing and do some good in the world, and at the same time get a very good return on your investment, similar to those, if not equal or better than those, that are not impact investing.
You know, I think there's a couple of things going on, though, Pat. I wanted to get your opinion on this. I mean, obviously, capitalism has had the social compact, which is that, or this understanding, I shouldn't say social compact. It's an understanding that there is no economic system that does more good for more people. So, yes, there are people who are on the lower end of the scale. And it, yes, it's economic Darwinism, but that's part of its strength, is its creative destruction and so on. And more people get wealthy with capitalism than any other system. And in our country, I don't know, I feel like we worship the rich. When you take a guy like Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, and the list goes on and on, people look at them as geniuses. They look at them as people who have accomplished great things. I think where maybe some of the fall off is happening is that now when Frank Luntz or anybody else does these focus groups or surveys, it seems that there's more people saying, are your children going to be better off than you were, just as you were better off than your parents were? And the answer increasingly is no. So is it fair to say that capitalism needs to maybe make some adjustments? I mean, the gap between rich and poor has, rich in the middle class for that matter, is brought up a lot. And it is happening. And when you have something like the pandemic and the wealthiest, the super wealthy become even more wealthy during that time, not because they did anything wrong, but there are people who kind of stand back and question a little bit, like, what's going on here when we get hurt during a global pandemic, a once in 100-year thing, and the rich get richer, even the super rich get richer, even during the hardest of times.
Yeah, I think this all started with the recession in 2008. I mean, it was very painful, and especially for the younger generation. And wages have not kept up, as we know. I mean, they're finally starting to increase wages, but they haven't kept up for decades. So people have suffered through that. And then the stock market takes off. And now those that are invested in the stock market, which are typically those more successful people in this country, their net worth by doing nothing has increased. And so the economy is doing well, but yet the younger generation is just starting out, trying to recover from a recession. Now they can find jobs easily, but back then it wasn't the case. Wages are low, and especially in California, real estate is so high. Many of them, as we've learned, are staying home much, much longer, getting married much later in life, because economics dictate that. They just can't really afford it. So I think when you look at that, that explains why there maybe is this negativism toward capitalism, because they know they can't make it. I think in addition to that, there is this disparity between the wealthy and the poor. And absolutely, that disparity is greater than it's ever been. But there's other reasons for that. In this country, we generate more white collar jobs that pay more money now, right? And so those lower paying jobs are being done by other countries. And so we have more people kind of at the top that are getting wealthier, I think. And, you know, the jobs are different than they were decades ago, those jobs that are being created. And so there are less jobs, I think, in the middle. And yes, the middle class has really suffered. And they're paying, you know, more maybe in some cases in taxes, not necessarily on a percentage basis, but again, based on where they are in kind of their economic life. And I think that has contributed to this, again, this negativism toward capitalism in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I point out to people that I think is really going on here, when we moved from the agricultural into the industrial revolution, there was tremendous pain there, because you're talking about a seismic economic and social shift. And despite the fact that we've been saying for many years now, it seems like where we've entered the information age, it hasn't really landed. The information age is really landing in a big way now, because now we're facing automation and robotics and all kinds of displacements going on. Even though I think most people, as they look to the future, most thinking people who look to the future, and when I say thinking people, I mean informed people, look to the future. They see a very bright future there, but the question is, you know, how long is it going to take to get there? Probably not that long, but the shift is, you know, is it, there's wailing and gnashing of teeth along the way. But one segment of our economy that has done very, very well has been family businesses, correct? I mean, family businesses have done, their assets have escalated. They've professionalized in a big way. I mean, give us a kind of a sketch of where family businesses are today versus, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, family businesses have struggled just like regular businesses through the pandemic. But family businesses are more flexible. And they plan for the long term. So they don't need to worry about quarterly profits in most cases. They can make changes quickly. They can do things like totally eliminate shareholder distributions, right? So they're more agile. And I think that they have weathered this pandemic much better. As example, in our survey this year, 90% of them kept their employees employed, even some of them that shut down, because they know how valuable their employees are for the long term. They plan their businesses as a legacy, and they plan it as sustainability for the community as well, which is so important. So they have done better. Some of them done better because of the pandemic, because of course they worked in industries that the pandemic benefited them. They made products that were needed during the pandemic. And generally, like I said, I think that they have been able to weather the storm and plan for the long term. So they are doing well. And most people don't know this, but 87% of the businesses in America are family-owned businesses. And they provide 59% of the workforce, or 83 million jobs, and 54% of the GDP. So they are a very, very important part of this economy. And we remind legislators of that all the time, because unfortunately, there appears to be more positive legislation helping corporate America than there is the family businesses.
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, what's the maxim? We have capitalism on Main Street and socialism on Wall Street. If you're a small business person and you're in trouble, you're on your own, which is capitalism. But Wall Street, it doesn't seem to apply to Wall Street. And that frustrates a lot of people in this country. By the way, I asked you a confused question because I was thinking, I don't know why, but my head was family offices, which have done very, very well, families that accumulate money and so on. But when we're talking about family businesses, that's a different animal altogether. Also, one of the misconceptions among a lot of people is that if you own a business, you must be rich. And there's a lot of people who own businesses who it's hand to mouth. It's you struggle to make ends meet, you have payroll to make, and you hit these hard times like what has happened. What about that whole situation, though? You know, socialism on Wall Street, capitalism on Main Street. Do you not believe there's some truth to that, that Wall Street's treated entirely differently? I mean, that's what you were indicating, that legislation seems to always be focused on the biggest players that make the, let's face it, they're the ones who are making campaign contributions.
Well, what I think is really important to remember is the last tax bill was during the Trump administration. Corporate America, as you're talking about, you know, primarily public companies, C-Corps, they got a 21% tax rate. Family businesses typically operate through pass-through entities, and those are LLCs, LPs, S-Corps, trusts. The survey that we did showed that 79% of all family business owners operate through pass-throughs. Well, pass-through organizations pay 30 to 35% in taxes, income taxes, because they're paying ordinary income tax rates. They're not paying corporate tax. So that tax bill, which had some very good things in it for the economy, didn't help family businesses substantially because they're still paying these 30 to 35%, whereas corporate America is paying 21%, to your point. There is that disparity, and that's really, really unfortunate. I don't think, and I do think this Congress really has had attack on family businesses. The legislation that was proposed in the Build Back Better Act in the House that ultimately, fortunately, did not get to the Senate had things in it like a total elimination of grantor trusts, which is how family businesses plan their business, and the succession of their business. It had increase in income tax, estate tax. It was going to disallow private stock to be held in an IRA. So if a family business had stock in their family business stock was held in their IRA, they would have to get it out of their IRA. And that has a substantial cost associated to it. And there's this proposal that just came out in President Biden's Green Book around a unrealized tax on wealth. Well, think about it. As you just mentioned, you know, family businesses are perceived as wealthy. Well, there is liquid wealth and there's non-liquid wealth. And family businesses typically have non-liquid wealth. But what if there truly was this unrealized tax? And Senator Wyden has also proposed legislation around this same kind of concept. Family businesses would have to have their business valued maybe every single year, first of all, which is a huge undertaking. And they would have to pay a tax on any of the unrealized gains. And that percent varies depending on what the legislation is. Well, first of all, that's a horrendous tax because you probably don't have any liquidity to pay the tax on it. And that would really be very damaging to family businesses. What they're trying to get at is they're trying to get at these large individual stock holdings, right? And we hear this all the time. Congress tends to focus on the abusers as opposed to the people that are really making things happen in this country. And I think that's unfortunate. You're always going to have abusers. You're always going to have people that are very aggressive in their tax planning and do things that the majority of Americans would never do. And we're not going to change that. And to try and legislate for those abusers, I think is very difficult. And unfortunately, I think organizations like family businesses kind of get thrown under the bus.
How are family businesses different from non-family businesses? What do people need to know about the difference between the two?
Well, typically a family business is defined if the family owns the business, majority owned, they control it by either ownership or management. And again, that's 87, with that definition, 87% of the businesses in America would be family-owned businesses. And that could include some public family-owned businesses, right? A family mm-hmm. could be a public business and public stock, but the family controls the largest block of stock. So they would be called a family business. And there are some of those largest businesses in America that are actually family-owned businesses.
So such as Walmart, correct?
Right. Correct.
Well, name a few of them, Pat.
Well,
there's Walmart and what is Johnson & Johnson still a family-owned business?
I believe so, as well as Mars family. There's also Ford. You can look them up. Most of them are very private. Most family businesses are very private, but not to say that they're not also have a public stock. I take that back. Mars is not a public company.
Okay. And not a family owned company.
But Mars is a family owned company. Yes, it is.
Oh, but it's not a public company. I see. Exactly. I see what you're saying. Yeah. But Walmart, for instance, publicly traded, but the majority of the stock is owned by the Walton family. I believe that's still the case.
Correct. As in the case like of Murphy's Oil, right? It's a public company, but it's controlled by the family.
Got it. What are some of the misperceptions of family businesses? And I mean, family businesses do have advocacy. I mean, it's not just your organization. There's advocates for family businesses. But what are the misconceptions about family business, say in Washington, or maybe more generally than that? Why the need for does it have an appropriate level of advocacy, and why the need for it at all? I mean, this should be pretty obvious. If we're going to be a pro-business country, you don't pass policies that punish people who create jobs.
Well, I don't know that we always are a pro-business country. I mean, there are legislators that are absolutely not pro-business. So I think that, you know, the reason that the work that we do with Family Enterprise USA is so important is because we advocate for the families of family businesses. There are wonderful organizations at a national level in DC, trade associations in particular, that advocate for family businesses. But they advocate based on the industry, and they advocate for all businesses, not just family businesses. So National Association of Manufacturers, excellent trade association. They advocate for industry issues. They're industry specific. or National Federation of Independent Business, which is size specific. They advocate for small businesses. We advocate for all sizes of business and all industries, and particularly for tax and economic issues that affect the family itself, like tax policy, income tax, estate tax, capital gains tax, too much government regulation, trade policies that impact not only the bottom line of the business, but the bottom line of the family members, because once again, that flows through to individual tax returns because they're operating in these pass-through organizations.
So when your organization, when you're doing your advocacy, your organization is doing its advocacy, what grabs attention? What, when do you get positive response from congressmen and women out there? What do they need to hear? And how does the advocacy, how is it most effective? What do you have to do? What does that look like when you go to Washington, and what really grabs their attention?
Well, first of all, you need to go. And most people talk about advocacy, but they don't do it. Even people in Washington, D.C., they talk to each other. They don't talk to members of Congress, or they don't talk to staff. And what you need to do is to answer their questions. You need to educate them. That's part of the reason that Family Enterprise USA did the work that we did in January of last year. Took us 7 months with seven professors to determine how many family businesses there are in America, the jobs they generate, the economic impact they have on this country, because legislators say, why should I care about family businesses? How many of them are there? What is their economic impact? So we went out and we did the work and we got that information and we take it to legislators and they say, okay, I get it now. I understand how important they are. And you work with them one-on-one, which is a tedious task, to get them to understand how important they are in this country and the damage that some of the proposed legislation or actual legislation is doing to these family businesses that generate 59% of the jobs in this country. And they talk about how important jobs are. Well, why are they disincentivizing family businesses to grow? And in some cases, forcing them to sell to a non-family business because they don't have a choice, because the legislation is so destructive to them. It's really, really important. And family businesses, again, want to plan for the long term. They plan their business as a legacy. They plan their business for their community as well as their employees. But at sometimes they have to sell because they have no other choice. They've reached a point in their lifespan where they maybe can't afford a second, third, or fourth generation of estate tax. And their only alternative is to sell the business to provide the liquidity to pay the tax.
Well, what is your organization's position? No tax, no estate tax at all, or a modest estate tax, or an estate tax only for estates that are of a certain magnitude?
Well, we believe the estate tax is a wrong tax. It's not an economic tax. The only reason the estate tax is still around is it's a political football by both parties. The estate tax was conceived after World War I to fund World War I. It's over 100 years old. It generates less than 1% or 1.5% at a maximum of the revenues, the income revenue in this country, or the tax revenue in this country. It's not a revenue raiser, but that's the other argument that most people use. And it, the people that it hurts are the people that it shouldn't be hurting. So yes, you can do some planning to mitigate the tax. At the end of the day, you really have to give up the asset, or at the very least give up control of the asset in order to eliminate the tax. And therefore, it's not a solution. The people that get hurt by this tax are people that maybe didn't anticipate the tax, or they died prematurely. And I'll tell you a good example. I have a friend who has a manufacturing business. She is second generation. She was running the business with her brother. They employ 380 employees. They've been in business almost 80 years. They've never laid anybody off until the pandemic. They were very upset to lay off 46 employees, most of which they've been able to hire back. But unfortunately, at the age of 65, her brother, who she co-managed the business with, had a massive heart attack and died. And so he didn't plan. He hadn't planned because, you know, people never think they're going to die, especially at 65. And so they owe $60 million in estate tax. And it's very difficult to come up with $60 million in liquidity in 9 months after date of death. So the solution is she's negotiated with the IRS, she's borrowed money, and she's selling stock because she doesn't want to let any employees go. And they've been able to get through this. They're still working through it, negotiating with the IRS, which takes years and years. So that's the people that it affects. That's the people that it hurts. You know, not the people, quite frankly, that can really afford it. Like the Warren Buffetts of the world, who believe this is a good tax. He actually believes the estate tax is important and we need the revenue. But oh, by the way, his estate's designed so he doesn't pay any estate tax. So there are those that are pretty disingenuous about this tax and their position on it.
You know, there's the saying, money is the mother's milk of politics, Pat. And it's hard to argue with because people who really control Washington are contributing money. Is there any such political action fund for family businesses or for small business in this country that is actually lining the pockets of the political parties and key candidates?
I don't know that. I mean, there's all sorts of PACs, as you know, and there's 5,000 lobbyists. And, you know, what you hope to do is if a politician supports what you do, you know, you should support them. And money is one way to support them. But meeting with them and telling them your position is another way. And I tell people all the time, I'm a huge advocate for advocacy. I don't care what it is. I also advocate for the Alzheimer's Association. If you don't let your voices be heard, you will not like the legislation that gets passed. Because if they haven't heard from you, they don't know what's important. They don't know what you like and dislike. And so what people need to do is they need to write, call, email, go to town hall meetings, go to fundraisers, make your member of Congress know what is important to you. And do it on a regular basis. And I think people talk about it. And sometimes maybe they're intimidated by talking to members of Congress, which they shouldn't be. They want to hear from constituents. That's why they're in office. And while our Congress has a very low rating, popularity rating right now, and has for some time, they really go there with the idea that they're going to do what's right. They're going to do what's right for their constituency, and they're going to do what's right for their country. And they're principled. That doesn't happen all the time because they have, you know, they've pulled in the direction of their politics and particularly their party, whatever their party is, because they need the financial support of the party. So it becomes very, very difficult. But again, there are PACs, there are organizations out there that support candidates and support positions that those candidates have. In terms of family business, I'm not aware. I'm sure there are. We're Family Enterprise USA is a 501c3. So we're an advocacy education organization. That's what we do. That's what we think is really important. And if there is any legislator that we think is helping us, then of course we're going to tell people they should be talking to them. We are in the process right now of helping Congress form a Congressional Family Business Caucus because there isn't one. There should be one. Mm-hmm. And we are asking those members of Congress that own a family business to be co-chairs or be members of this caucus so we can elevate the perception as well as the reality of family businesses in this country and how important they are. And hopefully that'll help with legislation, more positive legislation focused on helping family businesses as opposed to destroying or attacking family businesses.
And what percentage of Congress people came from family businesses or have family businesses? Do you happen to know? I mean, it doesn't seem like we have all that many business people in Congress. It's a lot of lawyers and even doctors and such. But what about family business people who went into politics? Is there much of a percentage of that there?
There, I don't know the exact percent, but I'm guessing that it could be as high as 30 or 40%. There are quite a few, and there's some that are multi-generational. There's some that are large family businesses. There are some that are maybe just a dentist. But there are, example, Senator Tester comes from a long generation. I think he's fourth or fifth generation. of ranchers, farmers in the state of Montana. And there are some members of Congress that are very, very passionate about family businesses. And so those are the ones, obviously, that we're approaching in terms of being co-chairs or being members of this congressional caucus, which has to be formed by Congress because it is an official congressional family business caucus.
So you've been at this a while, Pat, and what kind of changes have you seen over the decades? And are things trending in a positive or a negative direction for family business most recently?
Well, unfortunately, I've seen the trend negative. And certainly with the legislation that was in the Build Back Better Act, and there's some legislation that's in it in the Senate, the version that's in the Senate is still very destructive to family businesses. And that's very sad. Generally, I see politics as going in the wrong direction. I mean, you know probably better than I do that the world is not moderate anymore. The country is not moderate anymore. It is extremes. And so it's very difficult for both parties. There's an extreme right and extreme left to come together on issues. I mean, they did come together on the infrastructure bill, but typically they don't compromise. They don't talk to each other. The party that's in control kind of does what they want to do, and they hope they can get one or two from the other side. And this usually means in the Senate, because the Senate seems to control. And that's why things don't get done. It's really, really unfortunate. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. And I do think that the Build Back Better Act, as I mentioned, had legislation in it that would have been very destructive to family business owners. There's still a piece of it in the Senate bill, and that is the surtax that there is on income tax. So they proposed a 5% surtax on individuals that make more than $10 million a year. Well, $10 million is a lot of money. Unfortunately, that threshold for trusts and estates is only $200,000. So what that means is if you operate a family business through a trust, and once again, your income is going to flow through to that trust, you're going to be paying another 5% in income taxes if you make more than $200,000 a year. And that's not a very big business, $200,000 a year. And oh, by the way, if you're lucky enough to make $500,000 a year, you get to pay another 3% on top of that. So you get to pay 8%. Now, this is something that most people are totally unaware of. We met with over 100 different members of Congress, none of which knew this was in the 1,600-page provision that's still sitting in the Senate. So again, what this means is they're trying to get at people that make over $10 million a year or $25 million a year, but they've made these thresholds for trusts very, very low. There's yet to be a really good explanation of why that's the case. There's lots of speculation, but they're still there. So we're very worried about that. Every meeting that we have, and we do a lot of meetings in person as well as via Zoom, and I personally do those, we explain how ridiculous these trust thresholds are and how they would impact family businesses that operate through a trust. And so that's the kind of legislation that is happening, and it's going to continue to happen unless people really fight back. So I don't see it going in the right direction at this point. I guess some lobbyists believe that gridlock is a good thing. I don't necessarily agree with that position. I would like us to get things done that are positive in this country. But I see that's where we are, certainly in this session of Congress.
So, Pat, before I let you go, what else do we need to know about the subject? What else would you highlight about family business that is important for people to know?
Well, I guess I would just reiterate what I said, which is people really need to understand how important they are to this country and the economy. And I think that that's been lost. And usually when I say the term family business, people immediately go to small business. And that's not the case. Yes, there are a lot of small businesses in the country, and they are very important, and they generate a lot of jobs. But there are medium to large size businesses as well, and we don't want to lose sight of those. And we need to remember that they're family businesses. And what we learned in our work that we did with Frank Luntz is the voter understands generationally owned family business. In fact, 62% of them would prefer that term, generationally owned family business, better than family business or small business. And I think the voters get it. They understand that a generationally owned family business is going to keep jobs and keep jobs for them. So I just think people need to remember, again, how important they are, and to make sure your legislators know how important they are, especially if you own a family business, and especially if you want your family business to succeed generation after generation and continue to employ people in the community and contribute to the community.
Pat, thank you for coming on the program.
Sure. I'm happy to be on. Thank you.
This podcast was sponsored by AppFolio.